What's up, everybody? Before we get started with this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, I just want to give a shout out to a few names here. This isn't all of them, just a select few. I just going through the list. Greg Main, Connor Trent, Nick Ledet, DJ Bowen, Joe Schwartz, Brian Larkin. Thank you guys so much for your support. These guys are members of Patreon, by the way. I think we have one episode left after this one to get registered for our giveaway of the Off the Line print by Valor Studios that was donated to us by Henry Sledge. All active members of Patreon, when we do the giveaway, will be entered to win, with the exception of the person who won the first print. Sorry, you can't win too. But all the rest of you, you're registered to win. If you haven't signed up for Patreon yet, head over to WTSPWorldWar2.com. Click on the link for the Patreon giveaway. Sign up, subscribe. We have three tiers. Choose any one of them. All active members will be registered to win. That's all you got to do. Thanks so much. On with the show.
Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. We want to thank each and every one of y'all for joining us for another episode. And, boy, I got a busy couple months coming down the line. I haven't had a substantial reenacting season in so long. Obviously, COVID 2021 kind of slowed things down, and then just life got in the way. I think in the last 2 years, I've maybe been to three events. This weekend coming up, programming note for you guys. First time in a long time, and a super privilege. We are going to go on site with the podcast studio in a box. And Carrie's going to go with me. First time Carrie has ventured out with me on a What's the Scuttlebutt podcast assignment. But we are going to interview a World War II vet. So we're going to pack up the equipment. We're going to go on site. We're doing that Saturday. And then coming down the line, Steve is wearing the, I don't talk a lot about Steve here. I don't know if a lot of you guys know Steve has a name. For those of you who listen to the Audible version, if you've seen the videos or whatever, you see I usually have a mannequin sitting in the corner of the room because I put my uniforms on there post-event or pre-event. The reason I do pre-event, a lot of guys don't do this. A lot of cats, you all hang your uniforms in your closet, so it's not a big deal. But some people are lacking closet space. Their wife don't want to deal with it, so they got to fold their uniforms up, put them in a shelf or box or tote, if you will, and they get them out, and they have lines and creases and folds on them, so you put them on a mannequin and let them air out for a month or two. But got Steve here in my Airborne. Got an 82nd patch on it. Sadly, for the second time, I'll be cutting off the 82nd Airborne patch to sew on 101st Airborne patches because I was invited to a fundraiser for the South Florida Honor Flights, and the Florida Flyboys have invited me, and the theme for this event is Air Corps and Army Air Corps base units, but they asked me, because they knew I had a uniform, hey, can you cut that 82nd patch off and put 101st on? Not that we have anything against 82nd, but we're actually going to have a 101st Airborne vet in-house. I said, being the true living historian I am, I said I will, but just a heads up, my trousers have the green rigger straps wrapped around the legs and not the khaki that the 101st would wear. So technically, someone with a sharp eye would notice that I have 82nd Airborne trousers on. The only difference is the color of the rigging strap. For those who don't know, if you watch Band of Brothers, which I just started rewatching it this weekend just because, you know, we had Wild Bill Garnier's son and granddaughter on last episode. And this weekend, I was just editing some videos, so I threw it on because it's not like I haven't seen it 1,000 times. Not like I still don't have the bootleg copies on my computer from 2002, but I digress. I'm watching it, and if you like notice on the first episode, they have the uniform, and you'll see the green patches on the knees going down to the ankles and the green lines around the pockets. Those, but when you go back, watch when they're wearing their uniforms right after boot camp, they're just straight khaki. Well, that's because after the first few airborne jumps, they discovered a flaw in the system, and that was the wind tend to blow the pockets out. And so what they did is they lined the corners of them. You can't really see it here, it's too low, but they basically reinforced the pockets with a thick webbing material on the jacket and the trousers. But not only that, the 101st just took khaki material straps. They tie it around their pockets, and then the 82nd Airborne has a green heavy webbing. And you literally just tie it on the knot, tie it around the pocket to keep your contents from blowing out, keep your pockets from blowing up. And then when they landed and got dug in and got situated after combat, you just cut them off, tear them off. They're literally just sewn in the inseam. So they were never anticipated to be a long standing attachment to the uniform. Well, the problem with that is when you have reproduction companies following the garment design as intended, you got guys complaining that the damn straps fall off. Well, that's because they were never intended to be a permanent fixture. And so when you, just a heads up, if you're getting into airborne, when you buy them, just go ahead and get out your needle and thread. And by the way, if you're a reenactor and you don't know how to sew, talk to your mom, talk to your grandma, look on YouTube, go to Walgreens or CVS and get you a beginner boy sewing kit. All my patches, all my stripes, and all my uniforms I sew on by hand. But yeah, just go ahead and reinforce those. And but yeah, to that point, all more reason not to get all caught up in fancy... Dennis, are you aware that there's multiple different times of stitching you can do on your division patches? Have you ever noticed that?
Yeah, no, I wasn't aware of that at all.
Well, so for example, I don't know if you can really see it. No, you can't. Some people just would use red stitching around that on the 82nd Airborne for the watching the video. But then guys who had time, you'd have a fancy cross stitch. So it looked like you had a little blue X. They would use a different color, and you'd have a little blue X's, or you'd have a Z stitch. And it just depended on how much time the guys had to kill. You're on a ship going across sea, or, you know, maybe your pass got revoked that weekend, or you just have a bunch of time to kill. Yeah. Or it was like kind of the one thing that allowed you to differentiate yourself within the uniform code that you wouldn't get dinged on. And so, yeah, you would actually see different types of stitching. And when I first sewed this on, I took blue stitching around the edge of the red and did the X hatch and spent all the time just to cut it off. So now I'm just like, if I have a uniform that is designated to that particular impression, then I'll do that. But I only have one airborne uniform, and just so happens a lot more often than not, I have to take the 82nd patch off and put that on. But just, yeah, going online, interview this weekend, World War II vet coming up. I got that event. Doing the airborne thing. We got the big train event in November like we always do. I'm hoping for the first time, especially because of what year it is this year, I'm hoping to get up to the D-Day event at Conneaut, Ohio, which is a good segue to this. It's nice to not be someone who needs the latest, greatest, newest things, especially when it comes to things like luggage or computer bags. I've been running the same. I ran my own IT firm starting in 2004. I think the last time I bought a brand new laptop was in 2004. Then I would just use people's crap that they would throw away. I would just rebuild them. But anyhow, I've had the same laptop bag forever. And I was going through the pockets and I pulled out these newspaper clippings that I forgot my mom gave me like 7 years ago.
Oh, wow.
These are the 50th anniversary newsprints that my grandmother cut out of the different newspapers for the 50th anniversary of D-Day.
Oh, wow.
Now, we were talking a couple episodes back about the importance of needing to know how to read cursive. Not only is there cursive on here, but this is my grandmother's handwriting. Now, being the fact that I moved to Ohio as a child and my grandparents stayed in Kentucky, I didn't spend a whole inordinate amount of time around them, let alone reading their handwriting, with the exception of the occasional birthday or Christmas card. And so here is, I don't know, well, she wrote this on the 50th anniversary. So when was that, 1990, well, no, 40s? Yeah, when, what, 90 something? Pull out the old calculator here. My math is horrible. Do-do-do-do. You can feel free to jump in if you know the math. what did we say, 50 years? Yeah, 1997, so the year I graduated high school. She wrote on here, and I've been trying to decipher it, and I think I got it. There's a few words that I can't quite make out because her penmanship, and that she's writing super small. She's writing in the edges of the photo. So this photo is a D-Day photo. You guys have seen it before. It's all the barrage balloons, all the landing, all the LCIs are up on the beach, all the Jeeps, all the heavy equipment. This is long after, You know, this is probably like D-Day plus four, plus five. I mean, that's, I don't know, maybe they actually have it on here. No. This says, photo shows LSTs unloading equipment on the beaches of Normandy, France after the initial D-Day invasion on June 6th. Yeah, this is probably D-Day plus seven or so.
Yeah.
But she wrote an interesting thing in the note. It says, these are the boats Preston was my grandfather, was on going to Normandy. Good thing the ocean waves were shallow here because all the Jeeps had been loaded. I'm sorry, all the Jeeps had full field packs and Preston couldn't swim. Then it said, note the Jeeps in the water. Now, I didn't have the benefit or luxury to ever talk to my grandfather about his time in the war. We know that he worked grave registration. This on here makes it sound like maybe he also was assigned to a Jeep. And for two reasons. One, she makes a note that his Jeep was loaded down with field packs and the fact that he couldn't swim. Wow. And then she said, note the Jeeps in the water.
That's pretty cool.
The one item that I got that my mom gave to me that he brought back is the first aid tin that goes up under the dashboard of the Jeeps. There's two clips in there. And there's a metal can, a first aid full, about this big. I'm looking at it over there. But so, interestingly enough, the only item I have from him belongs to a Jeep, and then on this D-Day photo, my grandmother makes two references to Jeeps.
That is pretty cool.
This one's a little more dark. This one is the famous graveyard in Normandy. Got all the white crosses. Caption is, World War II Normandy American Cemetery Memorial situated off the cliffs overlooking Omaha Beach in the English Channel. Let's see here. The cemetery contains 9,380 white marble crosses and Star of David's arranged in impeccable rows. The graves belong not only to the soldiers who had fallen on Omaha Beach, but also to service personnel who were killed elsewhere during Normandy and World War II. The writing is even smaller, so small you can't see it. And I'm going to read this the best I can. Let me start on this corner. It says, where did we read this? Preston helped bury the GIs in, it looks like she says mattress bags. I don't know if that was a term that they referred to body bags as.
No, that could be.
So Preston helped bury the GIs in mattress bags and ID tags. And ID tags. Later, these cemeteries were erected. But here's where it gets a little more gruesome. His company got to Normandy after D-Day, ranted GIs in the water, and then I can't read that word. It's, and this says, in the, ranted GIs in the water, and then it looks like it says.
Yeah, see, we didn't take that into account, the cursive. You have to learn cursive, but then you have to also interpret other people's chicken scratch.
And when they get to, you know, up there in age. Mm-hmm. And it's real small. His company, like I said, landed in Normandy after D-Day, ranted GIs in the water. And then it's, I can't make up these three words, but then it said, it looks like it says, I think it says entrails in the trees, or help got body parts in, out of the trees from the landmines.
Goodness gracious.
Yeah, so I can't, I wish I could make out those four words, but yeah, it basically sounds like talking about some of the more hardcore parts about being grave registration is, you know, the guys who got hit by landmines and mortars, you know, somebody's job it was to find all those parts and pieces. And
yeah, this is something you don't ever think about. I know, I never gave it two thoughts about what grave registration would have to do.
Yeah, and
it's something.
I mean, occasionally you might see a quick video where they're wearing the big rubber aprons and the elbow deep gloves. And I've even seen one or two where they have, like, not to get too.
Somebody had to do that.
Almost look like they have spatulas, kind of like you would see somebody using in a wood pizza oven.
Imagine having to crawl into a tank, you know, crawl into a tank and get those guys out. I mean, goodness gracious. I know, you know, never gave that much thought, man. That's, sheesh.
It's funny that.
What did your grandpa do after the war? How was his mindset? Was he?
He was very, very quiet, man. Before the war, he worked at my great-grandfather's dairy farm. That's how they met. prior to that, he was Eastern coal miner, Eastern Kentucky coal miner. So during the Great Depression, up to before he moved to central northern Kentucky, he was coal miner. His family is coal miners. The whole working for company chit, the whole kind of slavery thing. You know, now for those who don't know what I mean when I say slavery thing, coal miners back then, they didn't unionize. And so you would work for a coal mine. We'll just call it Don's Coal Mine. And they would pay you. If I was my coal mine and I was one of these horrible coal mine owners, I would pay the guys in what they called company chit. It looked like coins of various value, and they had holes in the middle, sometimes squares or triangles, depending on which way you spun them. But those coins were only good at the company store that I owned. And you lived in company housing that I provided. And so essentially, you worked for make-believe money. It would be like modern day. It'd be like you working for my computer company and I paid you in Bitcoin, but that Bitcoin only had value at my computer company. So they were essentially slaves. They couldn't save up their money and move out of town because their money only had value in that town.
That's crazy.
And if you guys ever think back to that song, 16 tons and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. That's what we're talking about. It's about coal mining and being taken advantage of.
Man.
And there was an interesting show on History Channel, Discovery Channel about 10 years ago. It was narrated by Billy Ray Cyrus. It was called The History of the Redneck. Where the phrase redneck actually came from is it was first coined. A lot of people don't realize this. Are you aware of the coal miner war that actually happened in the early 1900s?
No.
Mm-mm. Let me make sure I have that right. The advantage of us not doing this live anymore is I can stop and check. Oh, wow. Yeah, 1913. So basically, around 1913, a bunch of the West Virginia coal miners, they got tired of living in these conditions, and so they started to talk about unionizing. And then as a lot of corporations did back then, you brought in union breakers. And in this case, the coal mine company brought in the Pinkertons. Those old assholes, right?
Yeah.
And so you have the Pinkertons coming in, and they're doing what Pinkertons do. They hurting people and shooting people. Long story short, this turned into a full-fledged war to the fact that the Pinkertons were flying over in rudimentary early 1900 biplanes, dropping Molotov cocktails and make-believe and homemade bombs on these guys, that the other unionized coal miners started coming in from Eastern Kentucky, other parts of Virginia, West Virginia, and they were literally marching down to this area to go to war with the Pinkertons. And wow. How they identified themselves is they tied red bandanas around their necks. A lot of them did, to the point where some newspaper journalists saw them marching and referred to them as the rednecks. And that's where the that's where the term came from. Everybody thinks, oh, I have to do a sunburn while you're working out. At some point, sure. But it was first coined during the coal mine wars.
Oh, wow.
It's a crazy, crazy story to think that the Pinkertons, a hired police service, were literally flying over and essentially dropping homemade grenades and bombs on coal miners because they actually wanted to get crazy idea that they actually want to get paid in American currency instead of this make-believe nonsense.
What was the date on that? When was that?
Coal mine wars. Let's see here. The coal wars were a series of armed labor conflicts in the United States roughly between 1890 and 1930. That lasted a long damn time.
Wow.
They occurred mainly in the East, particularly Appalachia, where was significant amounts of violence in Colorado as well. The Cold Wars were a result of economic exploitation of workers during a period of social transformation in coal mines. Beginning in 1870 and 1880, coal operated and established by the company town system, as we just went over. Coal operators paid private detectives as well as public law enforcement agents to ensure that union organizations were kept out of the region. In order to accomplish this, objective agents and coal operators used intimidation, harassment, espionage, and even murder. Through the early 20th century, coal miners attempted to overthrow the system and engaged in a series of strikes, including the Paint Creek Cabin Creek strike in 1912, and the Battle of Everts, which the coal operators attempted to stop through violent means. Mining families lived under the terror of the Baldwin Felts Detective Agency. My bad, wasn't the Pinkertons. Sound just as bad, though. The Baldwin Felts Detective Agency, who were professional strike breakers under the hire of the coal operators. During the dispute, agents drove a heavily armored train through the tent colony at night. Let's see, opening fire on women, men, and children with machine guns. Holy. They would repeat this type of tactic during the Ludlow Massacre in Colorado the next year, which even with even more disastrous results. By 1920, the United Mine Workers of America organized most of West Virginia and Colorado. The southern West Virginia coal fields, however, remained a non-unionized bastion of the coal operating power. In the early 1920s, UMW President John L. Lewis targeted Mingo County for organization. Certain aspects of Mingo made it more attractive to the union leaders than the neighboring Logan County, which was under the control of the vehemently anti-union Sheriff Don Chafin and his deputized army. Response, coal miners, operators were used every means, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, that's the whole series of war. So my grandfather kind of came out of that. You know, 1942 is when he enlisted. So, I mean, this was talking about went all the way up until 1939. So that was probably still, you know, fresh in his mind. It's like, I'm not going to go through this crap. I'm getting the hell out of here. So he went to become a dairy farmer. Then to answer your question, after the war, he, I don't know if this was something he picked up before the war or similar to how Eugene Sledge and talked in his book that a lot of guys never wanted to hunt again when they came home. My grandfather raised German Shepherds and showed them. So my grandmother and grandfather raised and showed German Shepherds. He raised chinchillas for a while. He raised doves for a while. They raised and showed Persian cats. So like, I always grew up around animals, which is why I guess maybe I have so many of them. But they sold real estate because prior to the Depression, my grandmother's family were very well-to-do. After the Depression, all the liquid assets were gone, all the money was gone, but they had lots and lots of property. And so my grandparents basically, through the rest of their adult lives, they just sold off parcels of land that my grandmother was left. And then right before she passed away, she went ahead and gave her kids their inheritance before she passed so she could see them enjoy it. And she bought my mom, my two aunts, all homes in the same neighborhood in a small town in Kentucky called Warsaw. Like literally to this day, they have like one stoplight, a Dairy Queen, and a Subway. And they had an IGA until Walmart opened up 20 miles away. Then IGA closed down. So they all three lived on the same house up until my grandmother passed away. But my grandfather passed away in early 2000s. I never got the opportunity to talk to him about the war stuff because I didn't gain an appreciation for it until about 5-6 years later.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I'm like trying to piece all this stuff together with what information I get through family members and all that stuff. So one day I need to give you all the stuff I have and see if what we can figure out about good old Preston Coleman Woods. How's that for a strong name?
Yeah, that's a great name.
Now, you and I were discussing a few episodes back and people got a kick out of it. And I did check before the show. I do have my Call of Duty World at War. Now, it's such a great cover.
Yeah, it is.
Got the Thompson on there.
That was great.
It's amazing how, at least nowadays anyhow, it seems like we got to heavily rely on different forms of multimedia to reinvigorate and re-spark not only the existing generation's intrigue and history, but it's almost like the new form of history class for the younger generation because they really don't talk a whole hell of a lot about it in history class. They got so much to cover in so short a time that they, you know, as you read through your history book, we're going to do 3 paragraphs on Battle of the Bulge, 3 paragraphs on Normandy, you know, the paragraph and a half on Pearl Harbor. And unless you take a college prep U.S. history class, if you're just taking regular, you know, social studies or all that, it's very minimize, especially now more and more stuff has happened. Now they got to make room in the books for 9/11 and all the other stuff. So there's so many more world events, and rightfully so, that you know, that World War II chapter is probably getting skinnier to accommodate the history that's happened since we were in school. And so it's almost like, and I know a lot of people in the hobby, for example, Jeff and I have talked about this for a long time, people, hardcore reenactors always called Band of Brothers Bandwagon of Brothers. And the reason being is after it came out, so many people who show up at Living History Event wanted to do Air Corps, Airborne. It's like, well, I get that kind of being annoying, but we're all here saying we want to preserve history and remind people about the history of World War II. And then you got this huge thing, such as Band of Brothers, bring a whole wide swath of people that we would never have the ability to communicate with and bring them into the world of history. And to that point, video games does that a lot. I just realized through Facebook, I've been reenacting now for 11 years, going on 12. And during that time, well, shortly before that, World of War came out. And then you had Call of Duty, World War II came out, and then a couple
Don't forget that, you know, Medal of Honor really started it all.
Yeah, but I'm saying in the time zone in which I started reenacting 11 years ago, the two or three games that came out, when those games come out, kids show up, the Living History Man. Is that an M1 Garand? Oh, I love using that in Call of Duty. Ooh, is that a Thompson? Oh, that's a PPSH. And so they always say, oh, I use that in Battlefield, or I use that in Band of Brothers, in Call of Duty, or, you know, some of those guns even carry over to Fortnite and those other games. And so it's always interesting. You always know when the new pop culture vehicle to World War II is out, because the kids will bring it up.
I'm very thankful for it.
What's that?
Yeah, I'm very thankful for it because, you know, I can't think of another a venue that would have grasped a whole generation of kids as strongly as the video game did. It was like perfect timing. It's almost like it was meant to be, because I know it was fading. The history was fading. And all of a sudden now you've got these kids who haven't hit puberty yet, and they're just rock solid on all this weaponry and uniforms and history and dates. And what I really appreciated about, especially with Medal of Honor, and Medal of Honor had the advantage of amazing soundtrack as well, just beautiful music, and written by Michael Giacchino, who later would go on to do the music for the Pixar movies Up, the TV series Lost. He's done like just countless awards and this and that, and this great, great composer. So Medal of Honor had that. And then they had the amazing graphics. And I just remember playing Medal of Honor back when it first came out. It was groundbreaking, because this was like really good graphics and this amazing soundtrack. And I had sound system surround sound set up in my house. So, you know, here I am walking through the hedgerows, and, you know, over my right shoulder off in the distance, I would hear an explosion, you know, and then you would hear like this German like commands being shouted off in the distance. And it, for the first time, because of the video games, it really kind of transported you there, and you were able to feel a little bit of, you know, anxiety and fear, and like, oh my gosh, like this is, It was really something else. I'll never forget it.
Well, the crazy thing is what you're saying, the response you're getting was from a game that came out in 2000, 24 years ago, and was 8-bit, maybe.
Yeah.
And by today's standard, the crazy thing is, and it's the only way I can share it to younger kids is like TV, right? When The Matrix came out, like, oh, the graphics are insane. The graphics, you watch it now, 30 years later, and you can see the outlines around the CGI, and the CGI looks super rudimentary compared to the stuff we see nowadays. But back then, it was like, oh, this is so realistic. The insanity of the fact that we used to look at GoldenEye and Medal of Honor as being realistic, and wow, it's almost like we're really there. And we go back and watch it now, it's like, that looks like Star Fox. And I know that reference flew over a lot of people's head, but Star Fox was this futuristic game which essentially looked like an airplane cut out of four different color pieces of cardboard, construction paper, and glued to the screen. But that would be a great – I don't know if anybody – I can't imagine – I think our generation would buy it. I think some diehard younger kids might buy it, but I don't think they could recreate Medal of Honor as it was without having to incorporate the bland, beat-down, templated multiplayer drop-in mode now. You would have to have a parachute mode because every multiplayer has the Fortnite drop-in mode. And yes, I know Battlefield, whatever, started that before Fortnite. But anyhow, they all have to have that. But it would be great if they could just remake it with modern-day graphics. But I don't think you could reskin that. You'd almost have to redesign the whole engine, I think.
And what's especially with, I just really appreciated like how much attention to detail they put into it. And even with like, and they weren't afraid to put Nazi flags up and on the walls in the interiors, and they weren't making them the Iron Cross. They were actually swastikas, and which is like what they would have seen hanging there, not the politically correct Iron Crosses. And,
well, let's be a little fair. I am huge on what you're saying, but we got to keep in mind World at War campaign mode showed the swastikas. They only showed the Iron Crosses on the online version because
the Germans.
International appeal. When Medal of Honor came out, I'm sure they maybe made a German version and had the Iron Crosses. For those of you who don't know, post-World War II, you cannot have any swastikas on anything except for maybe some historical photos in Germany.
Yeah.
And so that's why in campaign mode, in the American version and the European version, outside of Germany, and countries who have the law stating that you can't show the visual representation of a swastika, in the campaign mode, they had the swastikas. It was only in the online mode because everybody from across the world played, regardless of where you're from. They replaced it with the Iron Cross. But to your point, I think video game, it'd be interesting to see if they made a German release of Medal of Honor. Germany.
And you know what, while you're looking that up, what else was interesting too, and another thing that I really appreciated about Call of Duty, World at War, and Medal of Honor, was that they would have those split scenes, and they would actually show actual documentary footage. So, you know, here's these kids that are actually seeing, you remember that? They would show like documentary footage of the guys going in on D-Day, and they would show the hedgerows, and they would show the airborne troops jumping in, and then you would hear Eisenhower's speech and Roosevelt, and you would hear Hitler talking and this and that. And it was like a really, it was amazing because we're educating all these kids and bringing them up to speed.
Well, it worked perfectly because those early consoles had built-in DVD players. And so even though the video game graphics were still, by today's standards, rudimentary, even though back then they were futuristic, it was quite easy for them to embed video because it made their game look better to the point where a lot of times on the commercials, they would show those video splash screens instead of the action game stuff because the graphics weren't as great.
Yeah, no, I really appreciated that. There's this one game here that I got that I played that it didn't really hold up well. It was put out by the History Channel. It's called Battle for the Pacific. Did you ever play this one?
No, I did not. I've heard about it, but no. The fact that the History Channel put it out.
Exactly. I didn't really hold up very well. And then there's this game we were talking about earlier. It's not World War II, but it's by Rockstar Games, who did the amazing
Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah, they did Red Dead Redemption.
And Grand
Theft. I don't remember if they did the Far Cry games or not.
No, I don't know if Rockstar did Far Cry. I have Far Cry 4.
Far Cry 4, and there's those five. Those are just amazing, so much fun. But Rockstar did this one.
Far Cry was put out by Ubisoft. Yeah,
so there's this one here, and it's called LA Noir, and this one is
of the like time
a, well LA Noir, it's like a detective, and the noir stories from the 1950s, and it's Rockstar Games, so it's this massive open world in Los Angeles in the 50s, and they recreated everything from original photographs in the streets, and they just recreated actual stores and restaurants and City Hall and all this, and you're these two detectives solving these crimes in LA, and they're all World War II vets and grizzled and combat veterans, and they're just not putting up with anything. But what's interesting is that a lot of the bad guys they come across were Marines at Peleliu, and they were—I mean, so everybody's a pretty tough character, you know.
Well, let's stop right there for a second, because I've often thought about that, especially even during the Roaring Twenties, Roaring Thirties, and they touch on this on Boardwalk Empire, but I think prior to Boardwalk Empire, maybe some of the old black and white movies like the. Oh, what the hell is his name that they portrayed in Looney Tunes when we were a kid? When Baby Wants a Rabbit, Baby Gets a Rabbit. the famous actor, I completely drawn blank, before our time, but from the 20s and 30s.
Edward G. Robinson?
No, what the hell? He was big in all the gangster movies.
Humphrey Bogart?
Yeah, Humphrey Bogart. Mm-hmm. Maybe they mentioned some of the Humphrey Bogart movies, I doubt it. But it makes sense when you think about it. Like during the Roaring Twenties, the amount of violence. You're like, well, how are people so violent? Well, a lot of those guys came back from World War One. They had PTSD, and you know, and these are guys who killed people in some of the most brutal way.
Yeah.
And now they're coming back. They have no.
They've got 45s and they've got Thompsons.
And you know,
and they know how to use them.
A desire to make more than what's available to them on a legitimate path.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of that same thing of that came out after World War II.
Man. Yeah. Can you imagine? Jeez. Being a cop. And, jeez.
So I looked online, 24 best World War II games of all time. And this came out. I don't know. I don't see the timestamp on this. Best World War II games. I've never played this one. And looking at the Medal of Honor Frontline. Hold on. I'm looking at the thumbnail, and this guy's got like an M. They're showing like the butt of an M16, so that's not World War II. Call of Duty World at War is number two. Let's see what this Medal of Honor Frontline. Medal of Honor series took top honors during the height of the World War II gaming craze. It produced arguably the most appreciated series Medal of Honor Frontline. We're fairly confident that you know exactly where you were and how old you were the very first time you played through the games. Amazingly lifelike D-Day mission. We'll never forget the moment. I never knew that was the full name. We just called it Medal of Honor.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was called Medal of Honor Frontline.
Yeah, that was Frontline. And then there was the second one. Was it Underground or... The French Resistance and
number two, World at War, before the world's most popular military first-person adaptation, modern and futuristic warfare themes. It focused on the biggest firefights that define many facets of World War II. In our humble opinion, the Call of Duty series entry that gets the nod here is the on this list of the best World War II games is most definitely World at War. The development engine used to help Call of Duty 4 Modern Warfare become the Reverend Classic. The franchise returned from the combined fast and fluid gameplay and exciting campaign that takes place mainly during the Pacific and Eastern fronts of World War II, which is, as we spoke before, that was the big thing that differentiated that game from all the other ones. Just about every other video game up to that point in World War II was European theater-based.
Yeah,
or
that's right.
The early computer games, you had B-17 Bomber, which were super rudimentary, black screen, green crosshair, and some squares. So there's a lot of like bombing games on old, early video game, like Atari's and ColecoVision, but it was super, you know, like 4-bit games. Let's see, Battlefield 4 is number 3. Battlefield 4, I thought Battlefield 4 was the... No, I guess it is the World War II version. Battlefield 4 did such a commendable job of building upon Battlefield 1's operation mode by evolving into the grand operations and throwing players into the fray of multi-stages that mimicked World War II campaigns. Then there's the Firestorm Battle Royale mode, which embraces total mayhem among the 64 players as solo players or squad engage in shootouts and use various war vehicles to emerge victorious. That was the one I said you have on Iwo Jima. The cool thing about the Battlefield game opposed to Call of Duty is Call of Duty was in your face. It's all, even on the bigger maps, it's still close up action. Battlefield, you're like humping for days, and you can like, you know, when you're shooting at people, it's a lot. You actually had more, had to have more skill than anything else to do good at it. And what I mean by that is Call of Duty is so close up, especially on the newer ones, that the kids know all they have to do is put the dot that's affixed in the middle of their screen. They just got to put it over the character, right? And so they crank up the sensitivity so high now that they don't even see. They just, it's all about getting that avatar in the middle of the screen because that's where the bullet always is. And so some guys, did you know that gaming monitors actually have a digital crosshair you can engage to cheat like that?
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah, so gaming monitors actually have a mode. It'll actually have the digital crosshairs in the middle of the screen.
Oh, that's lame.
And these kids, they literally just crank up the resolution and the refresh rate, and they turn up the sensitivity. Like, you know, you'll have a seizure watching kids play nowadays. It's just, it's all just moving so fast because they're not really.
I was never any good at the multiplayer. And plus, it wasn't really good for my morale because I was getting whacked by kids who were still had prepubescent voices and high pitched and. Did you see me whack that guy?
Well, it's funny when we
and I would be like, "Look, kid, you were only saying that because you're not standing here in front of me."
Carrie and I, we played Halo a lot, and then we played Modern Warfare 2, and then we met a couple of guys in New Jersey, and then we basically formed a six-person team. It was always the same six of us playing every night, and no lie, I think it was on Medal of Honor. No, not Medal of Honor. I think it was Battlefield. No, Call of Duty, Modern Warfare, or it could have been World at War. One of the two. We had the six of us. We had a 32-game win streak.
Wow!
Because we would camp. There's six of us. We'd find a corner of the map and we'd get placement, and we would camp. And about you guys camping, and it's like, show me a Battlefield manual where they suggest you just run down an open field. I mean, maybe during the invasion, but. Once you're dug in, you're dug in, and we would just dig in, and we would just destroy people.
Yeah.
And then I had to stop playing. One, I gained a bunch of weight, but two, between doing computer work and then holding controller for 8 hours a day, I got carpal tunnel syndrome.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And so I basically had to step away from it. Now if I go and play, I just get destroyed. So if I do play my games now, I'm either playing the previous mentioned Grand Theft Auto or Red Dead. I was going to
that Red Dead Redemption. Have you had a chance to play that?
Yeah. I actually have it on my computer.
I just love that game so much. Yeah. Both of them, one and two. I was going to ask you, I feel like the video games resurrected World War II and everybody's mindset. But then if you go a generation before, I really think that what revitalized World War II and everybody's mindset was Saving Private Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to show you this book that I picked up years ago. It's called Now You Know. And it says here, I'll just read you the... this is following the release of Saving Private Ryan, thousands of people posted messages on American Online to express their emotions and share their feelings with others. Culled from more than 30,000 submissions, Now You Know represents a cross-section of views and opinions about this remarkable movie and what it has meant to us. The outpouring of emotion was so great. And AOL, this was like right in the beginning of the internet, and they had the message boards.
You got mail.
And AOL would have the message board, and they had so many submissions that somebody says, you know what, let's put a book out about, because it's so moving. Like, can I read something?
Yeah, is that actually published by AOL?
It's on the front. It's got Now You Know, compiled by America Online and DreamWorks.
Okay, cool.
And it's got the Emblem Entertainment emblem here, DreamWorks, America Online, Paramount. And this was released in 1999. And like a sample here, it says, the caption is, a closure for mom. On June 12, 1944, my mother received the following telegram. Harold, killed in action. Mom, not so good. Come home. My mother showed me the telegram after we had just seen the movie. We had talked about whether seeing the movie was a good idea for her. She's 80 and in failing health. Her family never got many details in the exact circumstances of his death. She cried, I cried, for the entire movie, and much of the evening after. She said she had never seen the invasion so realistically. Never have I been so moved by a movie. Never have I heard the stories Mom told about the war. Never do I want to have to live them. Thanks, Dad. Uncle Harold, for serving. This one says 101st Airborne Division. My great uncle jumped into Normandy with the 101st. Unfortunately, on the jump, he broke his leg. A French family took him in and hid him from the Germans until the Allies could rescue him. How lucky he was. 2 years ago, I visited the D-Day beaches at Normandy, where I gathered a small sample of the very sand my uncle and the other Allied forces jumped onto in June of 44. I gave the sand to him, and he was so moved by the gesture, he would have thought I gave him a key to the world. It did my heart good to know that I was able to give a little something back to him, even if it was only grains of sand. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. This whole book is just all of these things, all of these messages that would have just been lost to history, but a movie came out and it just, this resurgence of, man, like, we need to honor these guys.
That's also a sign of the times, because it shows how we weren't a bunch of cynical, bittered assholes on the internet. Nowadays, it would have just been 103 pages of people talking shit about the movie.
Right, exactly.
But to the point, the reason that movie resonated so well, not only is it a great movie, but, I mean, let's look at every World War II movie prior to that. None of them were super authentic, even though majority of them cast actually served in the war. I mean, look at Donald Sutherland's hair in the Dirty Dozen. He looked like he literally just walked off the set of Dazed and Confused. I mean, they all had their 70s style haircuts. When you go watch Catch 22, they all had their 70s style haircuts. That's so true. Yeah, I know it's Korean War, but if you look at MASH, they all had 70s style haircuts. They didn't have 1953 haircuts. The actors weren't into method back then. And so you had all these longest day. Oh, apparently everybody who fought on the behalf of the Americans, with the exception of John Wayne, used Thompson's, because that was the only gun in the entire damn movie, except for the one.
And it was slightly overweight.
And the one M1 Garand they had, he was using as a crutch the whole time. Everybody else used Thompson's. You know, not to mention the god-awful square, weird chin straps they had on there. Just everything was just weird. Even though, once again, most of the people on the set served in the war at the time. You figure they would have known better, but who knows? And so that movie, the realism of it was so great. And did you know that the extras were active, was it Scottish?
Yeah, Irish soldiers.
Active Irish. Mm-hmm. You know, why not?
Right.
All we have to do is provide them with the uniforms. We don't have to worry about boot camp and all this and that and the other thing.
Yeah, they got the tactics. And yeah, that was so great. What a great idea.
Yeah.
I remember seeing that for the first time, sitting in the theater, and nothing like that had ever been seen before on a movie screen. And I remember seeing a World War II vet get up halfway through that, and he was just wiping his eyes and he just left. You know, that was pretty rough.
I didn't have the privilege of seeing that in the theater, but I did. My parents took me. I was in middle school. Schindler's List. I saw that in a movie theater. Yeah. And it was definitely quiet walking out of that.
Yes.
I think that should be required watching for high school seniors.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unedited. Just let it rip.
Yep. Yeah, that's powerful. And Spielberg was responsible for that as well.
That's what I wanted to ask you. Have you had the concerning thought of who's going to carry the World War II media mantle after Tom Hanks and Steven Spielberg are no longer making movies?
Yeah, I know. I don't.
I mean, you got the independent guys who, God love them, raise money and they make the best pictures they can with the limited budgets. But on the grand scale, let's think about it. Masters of the Air, Tom Hanks, Steven Spielberg. Greyhound, Tom Hanks. The Pacific, Tom Hanks. What other World War II movies have come out in the last 10 years?
Unbroken was kind of World War II a little bit.
Unbroken. I actually have the when POW. I worked, that movie came out when I worked in radio, and I had a stack of the movie posters. And I got one hung here, and the other one's got water on them, sadly. But I'm just thinking, Dunkirk.
And there was The Great Raid.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Oh, that was really great. It, and then at the end, they show actual footage from the raid. It was very powerful. I remember seeing that in the theater, and it was just dead quiet at the end, and they were showing the video footage of them actually coming out with the American POWs they had saved on that raid in Cabana Tuan. That was a really good movie.
I mean, yes, there's movies out there that Tom Hanks and Spielberg haven't been associated with, but there's not the amount of work put out in over 20-year span.
Oh, don't forget about Wind Talkers, which was just...
The beloved Wind Talkers and Thin Red Line, the two movies that just don't get enough love on this podcast.
Oh, no.
I liked Wind Talkers before I knew anything about World War II. I went back and watched it a while back. Everything from him wearing his dog tags as a choker to just...
I love the subject matter, though. I mean, I wish that they had...
The best thing about it was the opening scene. That opening scene was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
If they would have just got rid of, I hate to say it, even as a 90s kid, Christian Slater didn't help.
Yeah.
And obviously the lead actor didn't help.
Nick Cage.
Yeah. Cause I mean, they were going, actually, the guy from Joe Dirt wasn't that great either. Now that I'm thinking about it, they just need to recast that whole movie. I'm trying to think of anybody. Oh, I never noticed this either until I was watching it a while back, and I was suffering through it. The wardrobe production on that was so horrible that they showed Nicolas Cage got hit by a mortar or grenade or whatever, and he fell down. They panned around. His Boondockers had modern day, like, work boot tread on them. They weren't even like, I don't know who made the Boondockers for that, but the ones he was wearing, like, had modern day soles on them. It's like, what the hell? Where the hell did you guys find those?
Yeah, and that's the difference, right? That's the difference between a Spielberg production and these other guys that are just throwing it out there and just. Running with it.
My personal contribution to the effort when Jeff was down here with RJ Nevins and Black 17 Productions, they were doing Walking Point in my backyard. And that's when I went down there. I was on set and Jeff was helping him out. And it's the scene where the lead just got blown up by the grenade that's tucked under the armpit of the Marine that the Japanese booby trapped. And they set the camera down on the ground, and they wanted to get this great shot where the helmet was laying down. And so you had depth of field where you had the helmet up front, and then you had Luke in the back, and they kind of focused on his face. But originally, the helmet was spun around where the liner was facing the camera. And they're setting up the shot. I said, and I just met Jeff. I'd known him 4 hours. I looked at Jeff and said, hey, we gotta do something about that helmet. I said, go turn that helmet around. It had a Vietnam liner in it, that bright orange fucking liner. And it was right in the. And so Jeff went over there and told RJ, he said, hey, we need to turn the helmet around so that the audience can't see that bright. The audience won't care, but the World War II community will spot that Vietnam orange liner in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're up to date on your M1 helmets, but.
Nothing.
The liner is similar, but the fiberglass they use has a brighter orange complexion to it. And so you can tell a World War II liner from a Vietnam liner, like, instantaneous. And so we spun it around, and the scene worked out great, but just little things like that.
Yeah.
And I have to watch these movies, and I'm like, who's
going to take him on? Yeah, I don't know.
Well, hopefully not even World War II movies. My perfect example. Not to cut you off, but perfect example on horrible movies. Like, you have an armor on set. Season 1, episode 1 of Walking Dead. They got the opening scene. They got the roadblock set up because the bank robbers or whatever's coming in. And you know, the sheriff's all doing his thing. And they got the dumb little deputy there. He looks at the deputy and says, "Hey, stupid, turn your safety off," something along those lines. The deputy's carrying a Glock. There's no mechanical safety in a Glock. And so they show him hitting the button, which is technically the magazine release, and pretending that's like the... It's like, if that was big part of the script, give the guy a fucking revolver. Yeah. Don't give him a Glock. And then to that point, final season of Sons of Anarchy, which they had a lot of bad ones, but where Jax pulls out his Glock once again. We want to get into the fact that you ever notice in Hollywood, everybody's carrying around unloaded guns. Every time someone pulls a gun out, they gotta cock them. I think
I know. That's one of my pet peeves.
Gemma or somebody's down on their knees, and he goes to slide the slide back, and the sound guy gives it the sound of a revolver hammer cocking back.
What do they call that? The Foley guy?
Yeah, the Foley guy put in like an old Smith & Wesson. It's like, I get it. You guys live in Hollywood. You don't know the first thing about firearms, but... Right. Why don't you just go ahead and make that chamber revolve? While we're at it, it's just the little things. It goes a long way. The amount of money, energy, and effort. It's like, I don't know.
I did enjoy that Letters from Iwo Jima that Clint Eastwood did. I really enjoyed that. That was, man.
Flags of Our Fathers too. The company didn't he did those relatively within the same. Period.
Huh? Yeah, you sure did. Both of those stories overlapped. Yeah, that was wild.
And another great thing, and I think Jeff and I talked about this when it came to Jeff and I both agreed a completely underrated movie was Midway. But one of the things
I enjoyed that one.
One of the things we talked about Midway that definitely is a holdover from Flags of Our Fathers, and rightfully so because of the storyline. But Flags of Our Fathers was probably one of the first. I'm sure somebody can point out some old film that I'm not familiar with. But I would say probably one of the first American-made World War II films that took the boogeyman effect away from our enemy. They actually made them into... These are Japanese citizens, had to fight for their country, doing as they were commanded... And for the first time, really, at least on that scale,
absolutely,
as far as at least our generation can remember, it was the first time that the enemy wasn't being portrayed so much as the enemy. And they did a really good job about that in Midway, too. You know, obviously with the kamikaze attacks and all that, but then they would go and show from the Japanese Navy's standpoint what they were, you know, was going on their bridge and the decisions they were making. It wasn't just random, let's kill the Americans. You know, it was actually discussion, and they humanized the enemy in that. And I think Flags of Our Fathers did a fantastic job at that. And I almost wish they should have just called, I guess they couldn't because of this miniseries, but they should have just called Midway the Pacific or something, because it was more than just about Midway. They covered a lot of ground in that.
They did.
Yes.
Yeah, and it was excellent. Matter of fact, just last night, here in Castroville, where I live, I started a writer's guild, and we had a thing yesterday, and I was talking to the folks that were there, and, you know, the graphics were so amazing that when those dive bombers, when they would pitch over and they would start diving, like, you almost felt like you needed to grab your chair because you were leaning. You've caught yourself leaning forward. You were like, oh, my gosh.
Am I the only one, like, when I'm watching a movie, a TV show, or even a video game, the underwater scenes, you feel like you need to hold your breath?
Yeah. Oh, man.
Okay.
Oh, and that's another pet peeve of mine is the submarine movies that show the ocean floor. With the jagged reefs all around the submarine, because it's like, all right, well, they wouldn't be there.
The funny thing in
very special circumstances, they would, right, if they were going into Scapa Flow or whatever to try and infiltrate and blow up some British ships, but the Germans. But for the most part, if they're around reefs, somebody messed up.
Speaking of potentially bad movies that I haven't seen since I got into reenacting, so I haven't seen it in the last 15 years. But I enjoyed it when it first came out because I didn't know anything about authenticity or anything. But it'd be interesting as you having an interest in the subject. Where do you fall on U-571?
U-571?
<You're>
I don't hate it. I don't hate it. Just because I love World War II so much in the history and the movies, but it's not one that I watched it once, so.
Is that a movie that we think could be fixed with a correct director and set design, or is it just a bad script altogether?
Yeah, I think it could be fixed. Yeah, I think it could be fixed. The guy that did Greyhound, did Hanks direct that, or
I'm sure he had something to do with it. I know he was in it. I never seen it because it's on, it was on Apple.
you've not seen it?
No.
Oh my gosh.
So once again, once Masters of the Air comes out, I'm
Oh.
gonna watch those, and then I'll watch Greyhound, and then I'll promptly cancel Disney Plus.
Man, they just start right in on it. They start you right in, and you're just feeling that tension. You feel responsibility of all of these sheep that you're herding across the Atlantic to England, and you feel that weight of responsibility, and you feel the almost futility of, like, man, how are we going to get all these ships? And there's this wolf pack bearing down on you. It's really great.
I save me the emails. I know that Disney Plus doesn't cost all that much, but I'm of the mind that when I cut the cord and I went to fiber optic and then streaming, I didn't want to be that guy who's paying the same amount of money for 18 different streaming services I was for one cable bill. And so it's like I already got Hulu, I already have Amazon. I watch more YouTube. I watch YouTube more than anything else. I
Yeah, I do
watch
too.
YouTube, I watch Freevee. And it's like I had Apple long enough to watch Mandalorian and watch the right stuff because I was in it, and then cancel it because it's like there wasn't anything else really on there other than now that Master of the Airs came out. So I'll turn it on here once the whole series is available, and I'll probably burn through it. But I don't have enough time to like sit around and watch stuff all the time between two podcasts and work and everything else I'm doing. And the kid doesn't watch TV. She watches, YouTube on her phone. Carrie's not interested. And so it's like, why throw another $20 out the window each month for something we're not going to watch?
Well, I like, your idea is great, right? You just binge watch it at the end
Yeah,
and
'cause they
then
offer like a
cancel it.
3-day
Yeah.
trial. So
Plus, you have the benefit of not having to stinking like I do, having to wait every week. But being able to sit down and go through it. Yesterday when we were at the Writers Guild, we were talking about Masters of the Air. One of the ladies brought it up, and she was talking about how, because my office is all World War II, and so they were commenting about everything. And that brought up, of course, Masters of the Air. And they just absolutely loved it. And of course, I do too. I actually really like it. The one thing though I will say is it's just impossible to outshine Band of Brothers, because that was very unique, and that cast, and it was
it was a
it
moment
was
in
such a
time.
good script, such good characters. The actors, you just really, they just brought it home. Music, the storyline, and the way they were able to start off each episode with World War II guys talking about, and they didn't reveal the names, so you're wondering, man, who are these guys? And I guarantee, every at time the episode would start, and I was already had tears in my eyes before they even started, just from the World War II guys talking and getting choked up. And you're like, oh, here we go. And then here we go, you're in Bastogne, or you know what I mean? You're going into Foy. And it's like, man, that's never going to be recreated. That's very special. And I enjoyed the Pacific. I enjoyed it. I've watched it several times, and I love the characters and Scott Gibson, who did Haldane, or like Captain.
Yeah, I think people do themselves a disservice when they try to compare the two because
Yeah, you can't compare
they're
it.
completely different series. But yes, Band of Brothers, a moment in time, coming off of Saving Private Ryan,
Yes,
the
exactly.
veterans were still young enough to remember everything. I was telling Jean Garnier that I think most of people living history or World War II movie buffs, you could lay down six photos of the real people, and we'd know most of them. Show me a picture of one Lung McClung. I know who it is. I know who obviously Babe and Garnier are. You show me a picture of, you know, Buck Compton. I know who he is. And Shifty Powers. I know what he, I know who he, what he looks like. Popeye Wynn. I know who he looks like. Obviously Malarkey and things like that. So a lot of because they were out in the beginning of that series. So I know their faces by just by knowing them.
Yeah. Yeah. And to compare them is, it's such a disservice, and you're really limiting your ability to enjoy it because, and I would say that when you get, when you're going to watch Masters of the Air, just remember that, you know, for anybody out there, just remember that it's a totally separate, but it's got the same attention to detail. It's the same teams, and the music, man, they really take you there, and they show you the different aspects. They show you the French underground. They show you Belgian underground, and you know, POWs and P-51s. That even P-40s make an appearance, which I was kind of surprised to see, which I was glad to see. And you know, it's quite an experience, and it is really good. I've really been enjoying it.
It'd be cool if they would release that in theaters at some point.
I would definitely go see it.
I'd go see Band of Brothers of the Pacific in theaters. That'd be kind of cool too.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Before we wrap things up, first, actually I want to get to what you're reading here in a moment, but I want to remind each and every one of you, we haven't talked about it in a while. If you haven't done so, head over to patreon.com, look up D410 Media, or just go to WTSPWorldWar2.com, click on the link, and sign up for Patreon. It's only $1 a month, $3.50 a month, or $7.50 a month. We decided first month of April we're going to give away the final print we have of Off the Line. You guys can see photos over at WTSPWorldWar2.com. I know we've been talking about this off and on for a while, but we want to give everybody the appropriate amount of time to get registered. We've been kind of derelict in bringing it up on past episodes just because we've been so excited with the guests. So just a reminder, head over to Patreon.com or WTSPWorldWar2.com and sign up and subscribe. And also head over to YouTube.com, look for D410 Media. They're coming out. They don't come at the same time. What I'm doing to actually get people to see your content is YouTube is trying to compete with all these other websites where they're showing short content video. And like I put up a 2-hour long podcast, no one sees it. I take a 2-hour long podcast and cut it in clips like I did with me and Jeff, and people actually see it because YouTube shares it more. So we're taking these shows, we're recording them in entirety, and then I am posting them in shorter versions and edited versions. And so head over to YouTube.com, look for D410 Media, and subscribe and click the bell and all that good stuff, and head over to WTSP World War II and get a shirt. Hey, Dennis, what you reading, fella?
Well, since I'm working on a book about a B-17 crew and writing that right now with another author, that's required a lot of research on the bomber war, and that's exposed me to some really amazing books I had no idea were out there. And so I've been reading, this one's called At Hitler's Side. It's by Nicholas von Bello. He is Hitler's liaison to the Luftwaffe. He was a lieutenant, a colonel in the Luftwaffe, and he wrote his memoirs. Covers 1937 to 1945. Then I got this one I've been reading. I Flew for the Führer, a Luftwaffe fighter pilot ace, Heinz Knoke. His last name is spelled K-N-O-K-E for those that are not looking at the YouTube. Heinz K-N-O-K-E is his last name. I Flew for the Führer. And then Flakhelfe to Grenadier, a memoir of a boy soldier, 1943 to 1945. Karl Heinz Schleicher. Last name is spelled S-C-H-L-E-S-I-E-R. And he is a young boy who was assigned to a Flak outfit. And so it hits his memoirs of trying to take out the American and the British bombers. So that has been quite a ride. I really enjoy looking at the other perspectives too, the Japanese and the German perspectives, the So that's been a lot of fun for me to read.
I started this book a while back, and then I moved on to other things, but I recently started reading it again because I got that recreation of the jungle sweater, and these guys actually wore it. Everybody knows of Edson's Raiders and the Marine Raiders. Very few people are up to date on Merrill's Marauders in the Burma, the India, China, Burma area. And so I went back and started reading Charles Ogburn, who actually was a marauder. His book just entitled The Marauders. And it's very, he kind of writes in the way of Robert Leckie, where he refers to him, he'll tell his part in first person, but also has interviews and tells a story from, almost like a third person, but when it, except for when he's talking about his experiences, that's in the first person. And it's a pretty well-rounded story. And it's the interesting
What's the
thing,
publication on that date?
the publication date,
Yeah, was a is it a wartime book?
I think it's post-war. I think it's 50. Let's see here. What was the original copyright? 1956. Then it
Okay.
was released again in 1959. And then I have, this is actually the first print in Britain, from 1960. So
Okay.
this is the 1960
So that's
pressing.
really relatively soon after the war, so he would have remembered a lot more, and that's good.
Well, and the interesting thing too is they were technically a deep penetration force, and they were made up of American Allied soldiers, Indian soldiers, Chinese soldiers, and combined into a group. And they, from the time that they were created until the time they were deployed, they had no interaction with any other army troops because they wanted them in that mind state that we're out here on our own. And so, interestingly enough, they, when it came to the American troops, the Washington put out a order. They're looking for guys with jungle combat, and so a lot of them actually were pulled out of Guadalcanal in New Britain.
Oh, wow.
And a couple other guys had no jungle training. They just lied because they wanted to get out of the work that they were doing. But when they, even when they got put on their troop transport out of San Francisco, I'm sorry, San Diego, they went by themselves. They had no, there was no other naval vessels with them, no other army services with them. It was just them on a troop transport zigzagging their way until they picked up the guys from Guadalcanal. I think they picked them up off of down in New Zealand, and then they headed over to India to do their initial training. And so they trained over there. They had mule skinners. Weird term, but yeah, because they were basically started marching in into the jungle. They were resupplied by airdrops. They lived in the jungle the whole time. All their mortars and heavy equipment was carried by mules, and they basically spent a majority of their time in behind enemy lines, and they were just all about sabotaging and helping reopen the Burma Road. And so I've been reading a lot more on that, been watching a lot of YouTube videos and just looking for some content on it. I have another book related to it as well that's a small paperback, but there's like a real bad Marauders movie that came out in the 60s. Really haven't checked out, but it's very interesting. And there's actually a really cool YouTube video somebody put out where there's like six of them. Six of the veterans in their 80s at the time, I think, in like a hotel lobby, and they're talking about it. But very, very interesting how the whole thing came to be, and their purpose was to reopen the Burma Road, but they were also like one of the least funded aspects of the war. Like they got nothing. Interestingly enough, all the injured were flown out one at a time by on a Piper Cub.
Wow.
So it was literally, they were literally just out there.
How's the book? Is it an easy read or is it kind of difficult?
It's not difficult as in the fact that they're overloading you with stats and numbers and things like that. The language, that the author uses, I think by today's standards, it's a little dated, but it's also kind of, I think the easiest way to say is before authors started understanding the economy of words, there's a lot of like run-on paragraphs, and like you could tell that Otterburn kind of loved the English language, and you could tell that he was probably very studious before the war, because there's like a couple times I'm like rereading a paragraph like once or twice just to make sure I understood it correctly, and it's just, and like using words that are kind of not used as often as, you know, they once were. And like there's a couple of them like, oh, okay, I know that word, I just never seen it in print, you know. And so I mean, it's not a hard book per se, it's just the use
of language. It's not a fast read then.
Yeah, that's why I stopped before and restarted it. But I know the storyline's compelling, and I'm sure there's other easier consumable books out there, but the fact that this was written by someone who was there,
yeah,
I really want to read it from his viewpoint. So, but yeah, I've been reading it consistently, and that, and like the first two chapters was like pre-existence of like, it was a lot of it actually was kind of building the backgrounds and the history of Stillwell and the other commanders who went into organizing this. And so it's a little slow beginning, but it's getting in there now. And so that's what I'm reading. A lot of great photos in there. Yeah, one of the interesting things, and I was talking to this with Charles and one of the guys who recreated that jungle sweater, which we did think three episodes back, is since the Marauders are kind of a special forces, they only had like five things that they're obligated to carry. And so other than that, it's like, you can, if you want to use a haversack instead of a musette bag, go ahead. You know, if they pretty much wore a helmet, or a lot of them wore Daisy May hats. They all had the jungle sweater. They wore HPT. Some of them had jungle shoes. Some of them had double buckle boots. Some of them wore leggings. And so it was just, look, you guys are going to live in the jungle, so go through the quartermasters and find whatever you think will help you survive and do your thing. And so, you know, no, Stillwell kind of was a unique fella. No insignias, no ranks. You won't see a picture of a sergeant with stripes on, no lieutenant bars. It was just HBTs. We're going out there and, you know, with our mules and our weapons and doing our thing. And it was just very, very hard scrabble, because, you know, a lot of stuff they travel on was just pure jungle. They had to cut their paths as they went. And then, much like we saw in the miniseries Pacific, a lot of dysentery, a lot of dengue fever. A lot of the guys, I think they went in with the expectation, I think they thought it was going to be 80% casualty, 20% illness, and it turned out to be 20% casualty, 80% illness. And so it was like completely flipped because of just living in the jungle environment and dealing with that aspect of it made it hard.
Yeah, Errol Flynn had a movie called Objective Burma, and it wasn't about Merrill's Marauders. It was a commando raid, but it is very surprising in that it really depicts that jungle. Like, they were out there actually in the jungle, and they really did a great job of making you feel isolated, and that the elements were trying to kill you every single day. And the Japanese, they were the enemy, but you felt more danger from the jungle. And I really enjoyed that movie. Have you ever seen that one?
Objective Burma? No, I have not.
Yeah, it's really great. It's definitely worth watching.
Yeah, there's great film footage of them like showing the mud was so thick. Like, they show them like unpacking the mules, and then like one of the troops was like carrying the mules crap up the hill so the mule could get up. It was just such rough sledding. Yeah. Russell Hamlet, last of the Merrill's Marauders, World War II, dies at 99. That was back in 23.
Got to meet a lot of them at a reunion in Fredericksburg.
Oh, yeah?
Here in Texas. Yeah, they had the museum, the Pacific War Museum. They had a gathering of Merrill's Marauders, and I took a book out there and had them sign it. And
oh,
so I got to meet a bunch of those guys. It was pretty cool. I'm really thankful for that time that I was able to do that, go out there to those symposiums and rub shoulders with all these people. And now they're all gone. And that was a great opportunity. And yeah. Glad I did.
Yeah, I'm happy I got to spend the weekend out there that I did too. But so I'm reading up on Merrill's Marauders. And
yeah, let me know how it goes. You know, towards the end there, I'm definitely want to. Either way, I want to get it from my library as well.
Yeah, I'm so intrigued.
I love those first hand accounts.
Yeah, I'm so intrigued by it. I want to try to track down a quote unquote expert on the subject to have who has a better, longer understanding of them and their exploits, and who could come on the show and give us more detail on
it. Ooh, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, so I'm looking into that. That's going to wrap up this episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast. Once again, thanks everybody for your continued support. For myself, Dennis Blocker, and Jeff Copsetta, we will all talk to you all next week, or it'll be a one-on-one with me and a World War II vet, depending on the editing and how quickly we get that out. Thank you guys so much, and we'll talk to you all next week.
This has been a Digital 410 production.